stopped if we still want to
talk to somebody. Okay, thank you. Good morning, colleagues. I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education. Today, as you see before you on the agenda, we're having an informational hearing. We're going to get a little bit of an update on some of the items we discussed and worked on a lot in the 2017 session. Graduating students, college and career ready. Reports on ballot measure 98 implementation, chronic absenteeism, and trauma-informed practices. So, shall I go by the opening page of the first presentation and call up Lindsay Capps and Colt Gill together?
Madam Chair, I believe, and members, I believe there are sort of three different subject areas, but the agencies decided to try to do them sort of jointly, so, as I understand it. So, they'll be intermixed.
Great. And Lisa gets to come out and hang out with them too.
Co-chair Smith Warner, co-chair Monroe. For the record, I'm Lindsay Capps, Chief Education Officer, and pleased to join you today. I do want to note for the record that we do not have a presentation up, which we were going to rely on, so I don't know if we...
Can we get it off Olus?
I've got it here.
Yeah, that's true.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would suggest, I don't know what the presentation, I haven't looked through it yet, but I hope that Mr. Capps and Deputy Superintendent Hill will talk to us about the governor's speech yesterday, which focused a lot on education and her Oregon Ready
future.
Which I agree with, actually. But what happens to all the 8 years we've been working on 40-40-20 and how they fit together? So I think based upon the state of state address so much on education, I was sort of, you know, wait a minute, I've been working 40-40-20 for the last 8 years, and now we're Oregon future ready, Oregon future ready.
So maybe any commentary you could leave into that?
Yeah, Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Wisnett, thank you for the question. In reflecting briefly on your question, I would say that part of what the governor was articulating yesterday was an opportunity to build on the work that actually we'll be talking a little bit about today, most especially around career technical education and creating pathways from classrooms to careers, and providing some additional focus as she's already directed her education cabinet around stronger connections between the education system and our workforce development system. So a shorthand way to talk about that is how do we make sure that as we implement career technical education, not only in K-12 public schools, but in our community colleges and public universities, that those pathways are resulting in jobs in our communities. And so I think, as you heard the governor speak to you yesterday, the opportunity for partnership between educators and school leaders in our communities with business and industry is really critical. And she also obviously outlined opportunities to be more focused in a couple of areas around apprenticeship programs. So I would say that the 8 years that you've referenced your work is a foundational part of what the governor is now adding some additional goals and directives around. We continue to focus as an educational system on high school and college completion. We continue to focus on college and career readiness, as we'll discuss today. And we're going to continue to do the work that we need to do around student supports that'll be critical for them being able to fully take advantage of career opportunities, some of which we'll talk about in terms of our chronic absenteeism work and certainly in addressing issues around trauma that oftentimes can be barriers to student success. So I'm happy to reflect further
can
on
I
that
ask
if
a
I'm
little
not.
Follow on to
sure.
This
yeah.
Sure, go ahead.
Thank you for that, Mr. Capps, Chief Education Officer. We've been working on graduation from high school, graduation from college, and those rates. You know, I've been real happy with Mr. Tim Nesbitt when we actually higher education funding now is based upon graduation, not admission. I heard the governor tell me in Oregon that the objective in our education system now is to have a job that's family wage job and successful citizen. Not so much, you know, that we focus on that, whether that comes directly from K-12. Or through community college or four-year university. So did I hear that right, that the goal is maybe not graduation, it's training, some way training, in terms apprenticeships, you mentioned apprenticeship a lot, to get to a good wage-paying job, not necessarily a degree. Did I miss the governor's direction or goal for the state of Oregon?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Wisden, I think it's a great question that you've asked. I think what we've been talking about all along and the governor has championed is multiple pathways for our kids. As we travel around to a lot of rural communities in this state, and as we've seen really successful partnerships that have emerged in many regions of the state around career technical education, one of the things we hear is we've got to make sure that we provide opportunities for career development so that opportunity is available to more students. And so that doesn't mean a shift of focus in terms of making sure that we have opportunities for students to go to our community colleges. The governor's been very supportive of Oregon Promise as a means of helping students transition into post-secondary. We've done work around Senate Bill 418 to help with some of the supports and counseling and guidance. You attended the Reach Higher Summit in Bend that was focused around that. So we want to continue to help students find that path to a community college or a four-year degree. But we also recognize for a lot of students in our system, that may not be the best option at first, and that being able to come out of high school with a job is a good opportunity for them. And by building more pathways into our schools, as we're seeing in many communities across the state, that helps us help them complete high school because they see a relevant outcome to that education, and it really helps us strengthen the economic vitality of our communities. By providing those opportunities, especially as we look at, as the governor mentioned yesterday, higher wage, high demand jobs that too often are being filled by out-of-state individuals. So I think it's a yes and conversation going forward in terms of career readiness and college readiness.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wisden. And I was going to, if I may briefly, Senator Monroe, I agree. I think it is a yes and. And I would argue that, you know, 40-40-20, what we talk most about is that middle 40, because that's really the hardest to get to. We are, we are at like 33 or 34% of the 40, and it's that middle 40 that we're in the teens on. And so the idea of having those more pathways and more apprenticeships, I agree that it's a yes and conversation. And I think it does dovetail, and I get that. I think you do kind of have to think through it a little bit, and it's a slightly different angle in some ways. And at the same time, the more I think about the middle 40 focus, the better I feel about it. Senator Monroe?
Yeah, that was basically going to be my same comment. We're thinking alike today, that the governor's speech yesterday did kind of zero in on the middle 40, CTE and so on, community college. That was, her speech was not in any way in conflict with our emphasis on 40-40-20, but just zeroed in on that middle 40.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Lively, are you able to speak this morning?
I'm going to try. Thank
okay.
you. And I appreciate this conversation and look forward to some more, because I'm still, and I understand what you're saying, the focus on the 40, but for me, having come from a different direction, and especially out in the public hearing this, how you define success in that 40%, because many people are still defining that as a two-year degree or certificate of completion, and it appears getting a successful, high-paying, successful job, though also is one of those, and if indeed that's the case, is at that point we call that success, or it's only success when they've reached some other level. So I think we need to have ongoing conversations about that.
Thank you, Representative. Okay. go ahead and...
Co-Chair Smith Warnock, Co-Chairman Rowe, thank you again for the record. Lindsay Capps, Chief Education Officer, thank you again for the opportunity to address you today and provide an update on several initiatives that the legislature approved in the 2017 session around the High School and College and Career Readiness Act, otherwise known as Measure 98, and some of the Senate Bill 183 investments the governor proposed around chronic absenteeism and trauma-informed practices. We're excited to provide you some additional information about these initiatives as they are being implemented, and to continue to engage with this subcommittee as you think about prospective budgets and how these programs can continue to grow and evolve in meeting the needs of our students. I'm going to turn it over to Cole Gill, our acting K-12 schools chief, to walk through some of our initial work around chronic absenteeism that was outlined in Senate Bill 183. And then we'll talk a little bit about the trauma-informed pilot that is in its second year, and finish with a discussion of Measure 98. And be happy to answer your questions as we go along. So thank you for the time.
Okay, Co-Chair Smith Warner and Monroe, thanks again for the time. I am Colt Gill, Acting Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction for Oregon. And I will say that these initiatives cross-agency, actually some of them cross multiple agencies, but we have two here to present on them. And we'll play a little bit of musical chairs throughout this. So we do have Jonna Timms, who is a director in the Office of Teaching and Learning and Assessment, who will be focusing in on some of the more detailed work around chronic absenteeism and the High School Success Measure 98 work that she's been leading for our department. And then we'll also have Laura Lean, who is a research analyst for the Chief Education Office, who will focus in on some of the detailed work around the trauma-informed practices pilot. So you'll see a little bit of movement up here as we go forward. Also say, so we were, you know, asked to share information on these four projects that are underway and were all funded during the 2017 session. There's quite a bit of information here that we're going to try to put across this morning. Hopefully we've captured the specifics that you were looking for. And I would just say that at any time during this presentation, we welcome your questions. And if something we know is coming up in a slide later on, we'll just say we're going to get to that. But we're happy to key in on any of the questions you may have about this work. One of the things that we wanted to really do to tie this together is note that these four items really do work together as a system for Oregon, and we're doing our very best to tie them together tightly so that as other things or other efforts are added in, then they will also fit within the system, and we won't have one-off programs here and there that may not have the greatest impact. So we're, again, working really hard to tie them together. These are the four systems. There's the early indicator and intervention system. There's a $200,000 investment here to share with the legislature where we're currently at in Oregon with these systems and how we can move forward in the future. So that will be coming to you in 2019. We'll share a little bit more information with you about that soon, and also kind of explain why that's the top circle on this, even though it's the smallest investment. High school success is Measure 98. So that's $172.6 million in chronic absenteeism at $7.4 million. And that's to implement the statewide chronic absenteeism plan. And then we have the trauma-informed pilot project at $1 million. I think it's also important to note that the lens that we put around all this, Measure 98, the early intervention system, chronic absenteeism, trauma-informed practice, is that they are all related to closing the achievement gap for marginalized and underserved students. So making sure that every student graduates with a plan for their future, college and career ready. And that's really key to us, is to tie it to the groups that are not currently being served in our system. The early indicator and intervention system, we think, is really key to getting the full benefit of all the investments. The several million-dollar investments in Measure 98, the chronic absenteeism effort, and trauma-informed practices. The early indicator system provides a system around these funded interventions, both Ballot Measure 98 and Chronic Absenteeism Plan for Oregon called for early warning systems in our schools, right in the legislation or in the ballot measure. These help to identify students that are not on track for graduation early on in their school career, and then clearly delineate what kinds of services and supports they may need to succeed. And then once those services and supports are put in practice through these different investments that you put forward, it helps us track the progress of those students as they move forward and determine if those really were the right supports or if we need to make additional adjustments. So that's key to the success here.
Thank you, Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And this has probably been identified. I'm trying to understand when you say early, how early is that in the process of the student?
That's a great question. So Co-Chair Smith-Warner and Monroe, Representative Lively. So these are different in across the country. So they do start, can start as early as elementary school. And we do have a few school districts in Oregon that have early intervention systems that start in the elementary schools. Typically, they are thought of as high school systems. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Wanted to give you a little bit of an update as where we're at with the investments, each of these investments. So with Measure 98, 50% of the Measure 98 funding has gone out for the first year. It's committed for this current 17-18 school year. We had 255 recipients. The early indicator and intervention systems, that was a $200,000 investment. It's 100% committed and allocated towards creating the reports that will come back to you and doing the research that will come back to you. The trauma-informed practices is a $1 million investment, also 100% committed and allocated to two school districts that you'll hear more about, and a technical consulting contract to ensure their success. The chronic absenteeism, that's a $7.4 million startup phase, and then beginning funding for school districts this spring and through the next school year.
And Deputy Superintendent Gill, on the Measure 98 funds,
yes.
So I know there are 100, I happen to know there are 197 school districts in this state. So how do we get to 255?
Great question.
Are we giving some to Washington?
Yes. Yeah. No. Co-Chair Smith-Warner and Monroe, all this money is being spent in Oregon schools. But we did expand Measure 98 beyond school districts to support charter schools. That was an original part of Measure 98. So many charter schools applied for and received funding for year one. And then we also expanded it to support the Oregon School for the Deaf, JDEP, and YSEP programs as well.
Okay.
So there are more, and some ESDs also run some of these schools as well. So there were other entities that were eligible to apply.
Great. Thank you. Senator Monroe.
Hey, comments on early intervention are troubling me a little bit when you said that, in general, that's high school. That's not early enough. We know when by the time a child gets to third grade anyway, we know whether they're on track or not. And that's the time when early intervention ought to start, at about that level, I think, if we're really going to prevent the deterioration that goes on beyond that. If they're not reading at grade level by third grade, they're on a downhill slide, and their likelihood of experiencing absenteeism and dropout are much higher. So my advice would be, if other states are starting in high school, that's fine for them. We need to be starting earlier.
Yeah, co-chairs Monroe and Smith-Warner, I couldn't agree more. So.
Thank you. And Rep. Parrish?
We need to start early.
On the Measure 98 funding, you know, I know we've just started rolling some of those dollars out, but help me understand what you think school districts are actually doing with those dollars, because, you know, what I'm hearing from families is that, you know, hey, we are interested in seeing that hands-on CTE that we heard the governor talk about yesterday, but that's not quite playing out yet everywhere. So how do you see those dollars being broken out and being spent by schools?
Co-chair Smith Warner and Monroe, Representative Parrish. I think year one, first of all, we don't have all the data yet around how schools are spending those dollars. Some of them are actually saving those dollars to tie them to the dollars that they'll receive next year when they have their full plan in place. So they're going to roll it out all as one plan. Some districts are spending now and did have a plan in place. They're doing some of the capital work that needs to be done to create those CTE systems, so purchasing equipment, refurbishing rooms, things like that. Some are focusing the first year on the dropout prevention activities, so they've hired counselors and things like that for the first year. So we're still collecting that kind of information. Partners, Stanford Children, others are also collecting the information around how schools are expending their first year dollars. First year, again, didn't require districts to turn in a plan. So the idea there was to make dollars available as soon as possible. Year two, and we'll get into this in some later slides, districts are doing a self-assessment to determine where their needs are. And then they're demonstrating that they have met the four requirements for funding for ballot measure 98. And then they're developing a plan. So we'll have a lot more information as we move forward. But right now, I would say it's what we see in our districts.
Please. So without naming names of school districts, I am in receipt of an email that a school superintendent, not in my district, sent out to their staff this week that says that without a local option being passed, and interestingly, the tax that just got passed with healthcare is going to take $1 million out of their ed budget next year. That they're looking at a $7 million hit going into the next school year. What I'm assuming $7 million shortfall, even if their local option passes, means that they're going to be using potentially some of these dollars, maybe in ways that shouldn't be. Or that don't meet voter expectations. So how are we going to commit to make sure that these dollars actually aren't using to be backfilled and supplanting general fund? I mean, I am definitely concerned that we are not committed to the promise that Oregon voters thought that we were getting, which is CTE, and especially when we know that even large school districts in the metro area will be making cuts next year.
Mm-hmm. So Co-Chair Smith Warner and Monroe, Representative Parrish. The process, and again, we'll get through this in a few later slides, but the process for applying for next year's dollars does include districts to provide a full plan. So there are rules within ballot measure 98 language around supplement versus supplant in specific areas. So we should be able to track whether that's happening or not. And hopefully our application process will allow us to narrow in on exactly where they plan to spend those dollars, and then we'll have that available to report back.
Can I follow up on that?
Sure.
So assuming they have a plan and the state allocates the money and then come to find out that that plan doesn't get executed, what happens in the subsequent year?
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Parrish. What I would like to do is go back and review what the act actually says. My belief right now, so we'll get back to you with a more specific answer. But my belief at this time is that the ODE does provide technical assistance to districts. So if they aren't meeting the requirements of ballot measure 98. Or aren't meeting the goals of their plan, then we have technical assistance staff that ballot measure 98 also paid for that would work with those districts to correct that.
Okay. Watch that, I guess.
Okay, I'll continue here. I'm going to do a quick slide on the early indicator and intervention system. Again, a quick one because this is the smaller of the investments. But what I will note is that Oregon is behind in the development of support for robust and functioning early indicator and intervention systems in districts across the state. We have some hot spots of regional systems and a few individual districts that have created pretty strong systems. But across the state, we don't have strong systems in our schools. We have nearly every district that is collecting all the critical information, but having it in a system with predictive analytics that makes it available at ease to each of the educators so they can make instructional decisions based on it, that's the missing link that we don't have for many of our districts. For the 2019 session, we plan to bring you a report on what Oregon is looking like right now in terms of implementing these kinds of systems, what systems across the country look like in comparison to what Oregon has in place, and some different investment options that you may want to consider to boost these kinds of programs in our schools.
Representative Wisnett.
I'm sorry, we are Ways and Means, so I'm asking a data question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Co-Chair. What percentage of the students enter first grade with a Head Start or preschool education?
Yeah.
What, half? I had 10 teachers in my office yesterday from Ben Lapine, and they've got a bill they're asking to support and talking about how they're getting the real problem of kids coming in that are not even potty trained in the second, third grade, and how that really distracts, implements, or harms them from getting to teaching. I mean, they're so are we front, you know, we need to go back and front load or send those kids back to kindergarten? Or, and they're saying that there's a waiting list to get in Head Start. And what's our program that we started?
Preschool Promise.
You know, we need to, the teachers can't teach if they're having to take the kids to the bathroom and stuff like that. So I've been really concerned about early learning. Council, as the chair of that committee, knows that because I've, all the years I have invested in the Commission on Children and Family System that I thought was better than what we've got now. And I, so is that a problem? And, you know, we, you know, Senator Monroe always says, you know, it's, we got to start early. And this executive branch, the legislative branch, says early intervention. But those 10 teachers in my office yesterday said it's not happening, that they're getting these children. It's really a problem.
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, regarding the numbers, we can provide those to you. I think, roughly speaking, in terms of our current Head Start investment, I think we're funding somewhere in the neighborhood of about 14,000 slots. And when you add onto that about 1,300 in Preschool Promise, our new mixed delivery preschool system, that's a fraction of the population we could be serving. And I've had a similar experience. I was at Nancy Riles Elementary in the Beaverton School District on the first day of school talking with kindergarten teachers. And when I asked them, what are the things that you need? The first thing they said is, we want more preschool. So I think there are other factors that affected their practice, but we certainly recognize the need to expand our early learning system. And that's some of the work that we're engaged in now to think about how we can build out a targeted universal system of high-quality preschool and child care. And I think that's an area the governor is certainly interested in engaging more with the legislature to figure out how we can do that. And that's a critical foundation in our graduation strategy.
I can't resist, because I say this every time I have the opportunity. So Co-Chair Smith Warner and Monroe, these are fabulous investments in improving high school outcomes and preparing students for college and career readiness. These are primarily high school focused. Chronic absenteeism can span a greater realm, K-12. But honestly, the greatest investment the state of Oregon could make in graduation rates, in graduation rate improvement, is an strong investment in early learning. Yeah. We won't see the outcome of that for another 14 or 15 years. But in all of our retirements, we can look back and say, we fixed Oregon's graduation rate issue by investing in early learning. So I'll add that to it. And I can never resist the opportunity to share that. I would do want to switch gears now, if it's okay, to chronic absenteeism. With chronic absenteeism, I always try to talk about a paradigm shift, because we need to talk about this with our school districts as well as our policymakers. When we talk in terms of chronic absenteeism and regular attenders, you'll see regular attenders reports come out of the Oregon Department of Education. This is very different than how we used to talk about attendance rates and truancy. And one of the key differences is on this slide, that when we're talking about chronic absenteeism, we're talking about excused absences as well as unexcused absences and suspensions. So we're really talking about anything that is removing a student from the learning environment. This could even be in-school suspensions or timeouts. So whenever a student's removed from that learning environment, they're not spending time learning, they're not moving forward in their education. So when we look at chronic absenteeism rates in Oregon, we again have some of the highest rates across the country. You can see that in 15-16, we had 18.3% of our students chronically absent. That's 102,000 students that missed 10% or more of the school year. In 16-17, last school year, it got worse. So we jumped to almost 20% of our students missing 10% or more of their school year.
And just to confirm, that is, we are among the highest, and we count, and that's counting it the same way, because I know there, over time, there have been issues about graduation rates and who counts it in what way. But that's consistent counting methodology?
Yeah.
Can we rank that high?
Yeah, Co-Chair Smith Warner, it's counting it close to the same way.
Okay.
So it's using the same the same calculations across the states. The numbers that go into those calculations differ state to state. So in Oregon, we do period by period absences, for example, at the middle schools and high schools, and some states do half days and full days. So there can be differences in the starting numbers. But we do have a significant problem nonetheless, and our problem is even more significant at kindergarten and first grade, and again in the high school years. So we see this upside down bell curve with more chronic absenteeism at those levels. We also know that our chronic absenteeism issue is at least correlated with our graduation outcomes. So that's what this chart is showing. The scale on the left, the 0 to 100%, are graduation outcomes related to regular attender data. So students who are missing in our system in ninth grade, 0 to 4 days of school, have a 90% graduation rate. And so you can then follow it on down. That point where you get to 15 to 19 absences, 70% graduation rate, that's just a little bit under our graduation rate of 76, or of that year, 74-ish percent, 75%. So definitely the less that a student attends school their freshman year, the lower the percent of graduation.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, when I was chair of the David Douglas School Board, which is 20 years ago, boy, it doesn't seem like it, we changed one thing that really impacted this. We closed the campus. We found that an awful lot of our students were going to maybe two or three morning classes and then disappearing. We closed the campus, and our absenteeism dramatically dropped when we closed the campus. I know it's really tough, and school boards come under a lot of pressure from students, and oh, we want to go across the street for lunch or whatever, but it worked. And so I would hope that we would get information out to school boards and schools and superintendents that this is something they might want to look at. I don't know.
Co-Chair Smith, Warner, and Monroe, I agree. That can be one of those things that can really help. It can be a challenge for school districts, both in terms of, like you said, students, student and family pressure to keep those campuses open, but also rethinking the systems at a high school to, sometimes it means a schedule change to have multiple lunches so students can actually get through and get food in the time that the lunch period allows, that kind of thing. So, but it can be worth it. One more piece, and I'm going to hand it off to somebody with more expertise. So this is a heat map, we call them, of where the chronic absenteeism is occurring across the state of Oregon, district by district. So you can see districts that have what we would call extreme chronic absenteeism, so 30% or more of their students are chronically absent. Then the orange is the 20 to 29%. significant is the 10 to 19%, and then you can go on down. So you can see that the problem exists across our state from east to west, north to south, that we have a lot of districts that need some support. And some of these districts, we believe that chronic absenteeism is having a major impact on their graduation outcomes as well. And John?
Good morning. Co-chair Smith Warner, co-chair Monroe. For the record, my name is Jonna Timms. My name is Jonna Timms. I am a director at the Oregon Department of Education in the Office of Teaching, Learning, and Assessment. As Deputy Superintendent Gill talked about, we've been rolling out chronic absenteeism work now since August of 17. In December of 2016, ODE delivered a report to the legislature based on House Bill 4002. In that, we talked about a state plan, which I'm going to talk to you more about in implementation. But we wanted to talk a little bit about why students are chronically absent. Research tells us, we have researchers that have been working around this issue for the last 10 years, and specifically out of Johns Hopkins University, researcher Balfance talks about chronically absent students sort of falling into four specific areas. The barriers, can't go, the sort of aversion, won't go, myths, why students don't go, and sort of disengagement at school. And all of those things together, as well as a myriad of other issues, are why this is something that we have our eye on very specifically right now. So the Chronic Absenteeism State Plan, as I said, delivered to the legislature December of 2016, laid out our implementation for our ideas around implementation for addressing chronic absenteeism. Really landed in four different areas. I'm going to jump around a little bit just to sort of pull it together for you. In the top left-hand box, you'll see that one of the areas we want to focus on is a statewide and local awareness campaign. What we realize, and especially as Deputy Superintendent Gill talked about with that inverse bell curve, with kindergarten being in first grade being very high in absenteeism as well as high school, is that we really need people to know statewide it's important for your students to be in school. And I was thrilled when both Deputy Superintendent Gill and Chief Education Officer Capps talked about preschool and being so important to kindergarten. As the next kindergarten teacher, I just almost came out of my seat. I'm so excited. But really getting families, communities, and schools understanding why it's important for kids to be in school. Going down to the bottom right-hand side, we really also wanted to focus on some of our districts who are really experiencing the highest levels of chronic absenteeism. So in this plan, we have identified about 30 school districts that we've been contacting and talking about their issues around attendance and how we as the state can help support them with resources, with data, and all of those things that best practices tell us that school districts need to be more successful in this area. On the top right-hand side, a part of that technical assistance to specifically to those 30 districts, but really then statewide, is about building those toolkits and best practice guidance for districts around what we can do for all students to help them to attend more regularly, as well as then some of those strategies that we know help with the students who are struggling the most with chronic absenteeism. And then finally, on the bottom left hand, you'll see a consortium model. What we realized very early is that that local context around chronic absenteeism is very important. We can't say that the same things that keep students from not going to school in Portland are going to be similar to those things that keep students from not being able to attend in Powers. So pulling together regions and having regional consortia through partnerships, through work with ESDs, school districts, businesses, really take a look at what is the local context around chronic absenteeism and how then as regions they can come together to support their local school district.
Can I ask one quick, so I know BP is best practices, but what is TA?
TA, co-chair Smith Warner, co-chair Monroe, TA is technical assistance.
Great. And we are, I think, not quite halfway through the presentation and a little more than halfway through the time, just as a time check. And I'm going to recognize my colleague, Rep. Hernandez.
Thank you for presenting that. And, is there, on top of the localized approach, is there also data that shows perhaps what's happening at a macro scale in terms of childhood poverty, houselessness, or anything like that?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Hernandez. So yes, we have been taking data statewide from districts, looking at that from the standpoint of how we delineated these 30 specific districts and looking at the different metrics. So some of the metrics that we look at is the socioeconomic status of the community. We look at how large the community is. We look at transportation options in the community. So there are multiple metrics that we look at and then help the district to analyze in that, in trying to help students get to school.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe. So the next topic we want to address is the trauma-informed pilot project, which was first initiated through the Chief Education Office through House Bill 4002 in 2016. And we are in year two of a three-year pilot. And we'll talk a little bit more about what that pilot entails. But we do want to just touch on, I think, what really is a subset of the chronic absenteeism work, and certainly has broader implications for teaching and learning, which is trauma-informed practices. One of the things that, as we were tasked as the Chief Education Office in doing a statewide chronic absenteeism report and went out into communities across the state and had dozens and dozens of focus groups, one of the things that we started to hear in that conversation with different populations of students and educators was the issue of trauma, whether that was defined as experiences that children and families were having in real time, or in some communities, historical trauma. And that certainly created a sense of focus as we thought about work that you are now hearing being implemented by the Oregon Department of Education around chronic absenteeism and how trauma plays into that. We're also hearing, I think, and our Deputy Superintendent can speak to this as well, hearing consistently from both educators and superintendents alike about the important experiences that children and families are bringing into our schools that impact not only their learning but their behavior, but the trajectory that they're on in terms of regular attendance, in terms of academic performance, and ultimately their opportunity to succeed and graduate high school. So it's an area that I think the field, from a very bottom-up way, is helping to elevate our focus to this. And the pilot itself is certainly looking at how we could, as we think about trauma-informed practices, most effectively bring that to scale across schools and districts in the state. When we talk about a trauma-informed school, we talk about the four R's. The first is that a school, its educators and leaders understand what the impact of trauma is and what their specific role as a school is in promoting the resiliency of every child and young person in their care. It recognizes the signs and symptoms of trauma, not only in students, but in families, and oftentimes we see among staff. It responds by integrating that knowledge into policies and procedures and practices that are not only might be instructional changes in the classroom, but additional supports that not only schools, but additional community partners can bring to bear in supporting those students. And with all of these, it recognizes the need to take additional steps not to re-traumatize students in their experiences and staff, for that matter, as well as building the broader resiliency of not only that school, but the school community. Part of what also drives our interest in trauma has to do with data that we have from the Oregon Healthy Teens survey that was conducted in 2014, which really built off of groundbreaking work that was done by the Centers for Disease Control and Kaiser Permanente beginning in the mid-1990s, which has been updated in 2016, that really looks at a number of factors that impact healthy youth development. And as you see in the column on the left, these are the particular factors that have been elevated and highlighted within this adverse childhood experiences study. And you can see the prevalence of these factors among this particular cohort that was looked at in terms of a national study. And then you can see in the right column the impact in terms of what we're seeing in this state. This is some of the most staggering data that I've seen to demonstrate the need for us to think in more systemic ways about advancing trauma-informed practices. And a lot of this, to Representative Wisden's point, begins in early learning. But it is certainly a practice or a set of practices that we can begin to advance within our public schools. In terms of our pilot program, I'm going to have our lead researcher on this from the Chief Education Office, Laura Lean, talk a little bit more about this. But in terms of the mechanics of it, we were pleased to have this subcommittee and the legislature allocate additional resources for this biennium to continue the pilot within our two pilot high schools. And we look forward, I think, to the opportunity beyond today to continue to update you on the work. But again, it is an opportunity for us to understand how trauma-informed practices can be implemented effectively within our schools. And we're very excited about the work that we're doing with our partners in Tigard-Tualatin and the Central School District.
Okay, just a moment, please, Representative Wisden.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Chief Education Officer Camps, thank you. What's the difference in these children? Why aren't these children, are they the poverty that we get extra funding for?
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, certainly one of the possible determinants of conditions that we're seeing with these students has to do with poverty, but oftentimes these can be a chronic experience that they've had in their childhood. More often, it is a series or a pattern of experiences they've had, but certainly poverty can be a contributing factor.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Chief Education Officer, I appreciate the work your staff has given me in the last few sessions on addressing poverty, and we've done make some steps. I don't think this is terrible. It's, you know, not enough clothes, not enough food. That is terrible. I don't think, you know, there's too many kids out there in poverty. There's a lot of nonprofits try to help them. My wife's involved in the Assistance League. It probably is closed. I think we need accountability of the school districts. I know we're going to have all the alphabet people are going to disagree. That money is designated for school kids in poverty, and that money does not go to a direct program to give them clothes or to give them more food or to give them before school or after school programs or summer programs. That over I don't remember, it's 300 or 500 million in the budget for school state fund is for poverty students. and all the alphabet people come in and say, no, you can't tell us how to spend it. These kids need that help. And too many superintendents have told me, we spread it across the board.
Mm-hmm. Rep. Parrish.
Thanks. On the pilot program, is there a reason that we specifically chose high schools and not elementary schools? I mean, I get the sense, and having grown up in poverty, that the impacts that need to be made are when a child is also in those formative learning years. And that's not to say you can't change a child's life in high school, but I feel like we're missing the boat if we're not also looking at how we deal with putting supports in. And of course, you don't necessarily have school-based health centers at a in some of those elementary schools. I mean, frankly, we need more school nurses. To me, and I mean, school-based health centers are nice, but I feel like we're in a district like Westland Wilsonville, where we have 15 schools and four nurses spread across that, you can't impact a child's health or some of these things that we're looking at that we know if we can make those connections for, you know, vision, dental, mental health, and get those kiddos when they're young, that you can impact them across their education experience over the 13 years we're gonna have them. So why high schools? I appreciate Tigard Tualatin being in the mix as one of their, Tigard's not in my district, but you know, we certainly have higher poverty school districts where maybe we should have looked to try to address these issues.
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Parrish, I really appreciate that question. One of the qualifications for being a part of this pilot was, as you mentioned, having a school-based health center. So that is one reason why high schools were the place where we focused these. Could this pilot, if additional funding were provided, be extended beyond the secondary level into elementary? We certainly could do that, but with the resources we had, that's where we focused. I'm not sure if, Laura, you'd like to add anything to that.
Sure, I can add a few things. So Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Parrish, for the record, by the way, my name is Laura Lean. I'm a research analyst at the Chief Education Office. And I really appreciate that question. I think it's a really good one. And the focus that we're really working on with this particular pilot at this time through 2019 is to find a replicable and scalable process that we can eventually expand to other schools and other levels of education, pending that there's additional funding in the future for that to happen. So the high school is really partially the school-based health center issue, but also partially because some of this work stemmed out of the original chronic absenteeism work that was at a high school level.
Can I follow up?
Sure.
I guess my concern, particularly for younger children, you know, my kids went to a school in Wilsonville that we used to commute them to, and the principal was our neighbor, so we had lots of conversations about education. When the principal of the high school is out knocking doors because a second grader's not showing up to school, and they made a concerted effort one night a week to go out and knock on doors to find parents and try to figure out why this was happening, I feel like we need to think about how we get the right professionals, whether it's counselors, social workers, or school nurses, in with those, particularly in title schools. Mm-hmm. And Beckman was a title school at the time, to be able to make those impacts. Because again, by the time we're reaching high school, We're probably too late with a lot of these kids. Not that some of them can't be picked up and saved, but you've got to change those habits and in the formative years and address those issues early on. And so hopefully in a subsequent session, we can come back around and talk about how we do that. I mean, this is nice, but I think we're missing the mark, particularly when, like I said, you have school professionals spending their evenings trying to hunt down second graders. I mean, that is, to me, very problematic, more so in some ways than at the high school level.
Okay, I will continue. And maybe some of your questions and concerns will be raised as we go throughout, but I also think it's worth noting that our team in the Chief Education Office and Jonna's team in ODE work really closely together on these issues, because chronic absenteeism and trauma-informed practices really are tied together. And in some ways, one and the same. So a lot of what we're learning in the Chief Education Office, we're sharing with Jonna's team, we're pulled into a lot of meetings, and Jonna's team is simultaneously pulled into a lot of the work that we do as well. So Anyway, in the interest of time, I'll keep plugging away on the slides. As we've already mentioned, two schools were chosen for the trauma-informed pilot, Tigard High School and Central High School in Monmouth Independence, and primarily because they already had the following two systems in place, which is a multi-tiered system of support and also a school-based health center. For our implementation strategy, findings from the field of implementation science really indicate that the early stages of implementation must build consensus, develop staff competencies, and establish organizational capacity and commitment. So to ensure that the project resulted in, as I mentioned, a replicable, process-oriented, and scalable practices, we developed an implementation strategy that included the following. Technical assistance, which provides organizational support and partnerships, or helping the schools build partnerships with their health community, while health community members and other community members. We also placed two trauma-informed school coordinators at the building or the school level. So there's a coordinator in Tigard High School and there's a coordinator in Central High School. And they really coordinate and develop the professional development work and coaching for all of the staff at those two schools. They also are responsible for, and in collaboration with us at the Chief Education Office and in ODE, dissemination of practices via kind of various meetings that they're in attendance, whether it's at the building or whether it's at the district level. Also at the Chief Education Office, my amazing colleague, Dr. Cheng-Fei Lai, and I work together on coordinating the data to monitor and guide the implementation. And we call that a formative assessment approach. So when we get data in, we're learning from that data and we're providing that information back to the coordinators at each school. And that process is really iterative and ongoing. And so what we're learning is immediately communicated with those two schools and the coordinators there so that they can change practices accordingly. So it's a really good practice we have set up so far. Year one, implementation activities. This was last year. So the two school coordinators were hired at each school. They've started providing all staff training and ongoing professional development. They also attend and hold leadership meetings both within their individual respective schools and with us at the Chief Education Office. We've also created domains, goals, and objectives with respect to the implementation process and the evaluation that will come from this work, which is expected to be delivered to all of you in June of 2019. And we've also, of course, started data collection, and that started right away, and that's also part of that formative assessment process. And finally, last slide. In year two, we've begun to implement the coaching element of the pilot program. So each one of the coordinators is working on coaching activities, specifically starting with the cohorts that they've identified. And these cohorts are really working on building and understanding how to disseminate the knowledge that they're learning in professional development activities to the rest of the staff. So the coaching is starting small, and it's starting with a small leadership team that's selected in coordination with the coordinators and the technical assistance provider. And then we're eventually working to understand how that knowledge is disseminated so that we can create best practices or promising practices for ensuring that all staff, and we're talking all staff, not just educators, not just administrators, but cafeteria workers, school bus drivers, every staff at those schools, two schools, are going to be trained in trauma-informed practices by the end of the pilot. And then again, analyzing that data as we go using a continuous improvement model, which really looks at this idea of a rapid cycle of improvement, which ties into that formative idea where we get the data in, we calculate it, we analyze it, we provide that feedback, and that process and that communication cycle is ongoing and moves as quickly as possible.
Say briefly, I was at Tigard a couple weeks ago and spent some time there, and what you said about all staff was particularly striking, because I had a couple admin and indeed EA educational assistant staff who talked about how they historically were not involved mm-hmm. in any or much professional development, and they felt as though, as being so on the front lines of so much of the, you know, the results of the trauma, which is outbursts and other things, that was a really striking thing to me that more than one of them, like, sought me out to mention that to me.
Good. So. I'm glad to hear that.
Okay, Representative Smith Warner and Monroe, realize we only have
the easy part, Measure 98.
Yeah, a few minutes left. I do want to hit, move us on to Measure 98. But I also want to mention, in respect to Representative Parrish's comments, that this is the legislatively funded trauma-informed pilot project, but there are many projects going on across the state, and both the Chief Education Office and Oregon Department of Education are closely working with these partners. There's regionalized programs that are amazing in Southern Oregon Success Regional Achievement Collaborative with many districts down there, the Intermountain ESD region. There's a multi-region consortia of districts that have been doing this for about 3 or 4 years. And then COSA, one of our partners, has been holding multiple professional development opportunities throughout the last 2 years that both the Chief Ed Office and Department of Ed have been in on planning and supporting. So I think there's a lot going on in this effort that does span the K-12 spectrum, and the Early Learning Council has also been focusing in on trauma-informed practices with the hubs. So we really have a P-12 at least span in this work, and we're just presenting the legislatively funded effort here. So I just wanted to make that point. But high school success. So this is Measure 98. We are talking high school success now, so everybody equates the dollars we're spending towards the goal rather than this sort of arbitrary number. Just a reminder, though, it did spawn from ballot measure 98 in November of 2016 that passed with 65% voter approval. It focuses in on districts establishing or expanding programs in dropout prevention, career and technical education, and college level opportunities or accelerated learning, earning college credits in high school. Districts who are funded at the highest levels must operate programs across all three of those areas. There's a mid-level of funding for districts where they need to choose two of those areas. One of them must be the CTE. And then there's a districts that are getting lower levels of funding, and they can choose any one of those. And the levels of funding are determined by their high school ADM, average daily membership. Districts spend the bulk of these dollars at the high school level. They are allowed to spend up to 15% of it for students who have completed the requirements of seventh grade, meaning they can start the summer after seventh grade and then on through high school. This is a distribution of the recipients to date. Again, we shared the 255 recipients. 58 of those were charter schools, 176 school districts serving high school students, 20 youth correction schools, and the Oregon School for the Deaf. 133 of those allocated received less than the $100,000 per year, which puts them into the selecting any one of those areas to invest their dollars in. 17 districts received more than $1 million over the biennium. This is another map to, again, show the distribution of funds to districts. And you have this, so I'm going to move on and you can ask questions about it if you want. I don't want to get into the details of Measure 98. Again, it's important to recognize, while this bill is often perceived as a career technical education program or career technical ed and college opportunity program, the bill itself has a slightly different emphasis. It has all three areas that I discussed earlier. And inside this measure, is a little bit around how we evaluate the program. So the whole idea is that we're improving student progress toward graduation, beginning with eighth or ninth grade and referring to freshman on track data. So having teachers and educators of ninth grade students meet regularly around that data and develop plans so that students can succeed and complete high school ready for their next steps. This makes it very much, in our view, a piece of equity legislation that is focused on the students who aren't currently being served in our systems, because we're identifying them by their needs. So when we talk about high school success, this is the percentage of students who are graduating on time. You can see that we still have, while we are closing some of our graduation gaps, we still see significant gaps, especially for our American Indian, Native Alaskan students, our Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander students, and our African American students. One of the reasons to focus on the data is because we know that it can be a strong indicator of what's to come. So this is data not from Oregon. This is data from a Chicago project that showed that if we pay attention to the number of days students are absent in their freshman year and the number of course failures that they have in their freshman year, we can pretty much predict their likelihood to reach graduation. So in Oregon, a few years ago, when Oregon put into place the achievement compacts, we began measuring data like this. And so we have two pieces. This is the slide I already showed you related to graduation rates by freshman attendance data. So I won't dwell on that one, but I think this is one that we've seen strong correlations. So we began tracking a few years back the on-track data for freshmen in high school. And this has happened for 4 years now, so we were able to compare that to this most recent graduating class, and these are the results. So students who were not on track as freshmen had a graduation rate of close to 40%. Students who were on track had a graduation rate of a little bit more than 90%. So the more time we can spend with teachers really paying attention to the indicators that are going to predict whether students succeed and then identifying what those problems are, the more we can address their needs through investments like Measure 98 and really targeting them towards student needs.
And can you rattle off the indicators that you use for that specifically, and its attendance, grades, referrals?
Yeah, right? For the whole early indicator and intervention system, you're right. So, sorry, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, it is course success. So that's oftentimes by credit attainment or grades. It is behavior. So that can be suspensions, things like that. It's attendance. And in Oregon, we require students to demonstrate proficiency on exams to graduate. So we also include assessment scores.
But Senator Roblin?
That's true for all those indicators, but in this particular study, it is strictly one indicator, i.e., were they on track to graduate at the end of their freshman year?
Yes, and that is a Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Senator, Co-Chair Monroe, and Representative Roblin, and this indicator is only credits earned during their freshman year.
This one.
Yes.
Okay. So counting that one thing can give us this much information.
That's a Thank
good,
you.
Good point. Thanks. Okay, I'm going to get into some of the specifics around high school success, what districts need to have in place in order to participate in the coming year, and how we hope to ensure that the investments that they make will actually have an improvement in student outcomes.
Great. Good morning again. Jonna Timms, Director, Oregon Department of Education, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, and committee. The high school success has asked through the statute for us to look at districts establishing what we're calling eligibility. So what are those specific things districts need to do in order to be able to then develop their plans for around implementation? In order to do that, we needed to ask districts to do some self-assessment. And then the self-assessment, we asked them what were their opportunities for teachers to come together to talk about freshmen and around the freshmen on track, practices that they already have in place to reduce chronic absenteeism, course assignment, as well as bringing together partners from the community to support all of the pieces that need to come together for students to be successful. So a self-assessment was released, template was released in December of 17. January 31st was the deadline. Districts met that deadline, and now we are giving them feedback around their eligibility requirements, and then asking them through that and through their what they've said that they need to do with this in their needs assessment to develop a plan. And that plan then we will ask them to have that back to us March 31st. I'll talk to a little bit more about that plan next. Great. I'm kind of thrown off that my boss is doing my slides. Okay. So, high school success plans. The plans ask for vision, where they see the district as a whole going forward in developing all of these pieces that we know students need to be successful towards graduation. The eligibility that I talked about before, all of those pieces around what are the adult behaviors that need to be in place for students to be successful. We ask them to do some goal setting, to tell us what activities they're going to engage in to meet those goals, and then what are some of the short-term and long-term outcomes. Equity considerations, as Deputy Superintendent Gill talked about, are extremely important. We really see this as something that helps us close achievement gaps and really helps districts to address some of the equity issues and or concerns that they may be working on for students. So really looking at the Chief Education Office's equity lens and answering questions about planning, about implementation, and the technical assistance that as ODE can provide to districts with that specific lens around our students who may not have been, the system has not been working for as successfully in the past. And finally, as I said, the self-assessment information has come back to us from all of our recipients as of January 31st. Information is going back out to districts now, and districts are developing those plans to be back into us by March 31st. And looking forward to coming back and telling you more about what those districts are doing with their funds.
Senator Thompson.
A quick question. So was there a deadline of January 31st? How many school districts completed those assessments?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Thompson, how we've collected that information, and it's a little bit maybe a little bit misleading, because some of the districts who and other recipients who have not completed their idea around how they're going to even use these funds did not complete the self-assessment. So example, YSEP and JDEP is now looking at their systems for how they're going to use the funds. So most of those entities did not complete. Overall, we had 234.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty good. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions from this committee? Okay, well, thank you all very much for that information. That was a way to pick up the pace. and I'm sure I look forward to continuing. It's very helpful to know the timeline on those plans, because we all hear about them a lot, I know, from our districts when we're out and about. So, okay. Senator Monroe?
Yeah, question in terms of your research. I would like to know the students who have a preschool opportunity and how, over time, how they fare in terms of assessment and success in school versus those that don't have a preschool opportunity? That's one question. The other thing I would like to know, a couple of years ago, we went to full-day kindergarten. And I worked very hard on that, so did Madam Co-Chair and other members of this committee, to get full-day kindergarten. A couple of things. How many more students, what percentage of students are now availing themselves of full-day kindergarten that basically when there was only a half-day program or when they had to pay for a full-day program simply didn't have kindergarten? You know, that it didn't work out for the parents' job schedule or whatever. So how many, you know, what's happened in terms of kindergarten opportunities? And then, of course, over time, and this will be a few years out before we really know, what difference did it make if students had a full-day kindergarten opportunity in terms of their overall success in school? I need to know that.
If I can preface that before they go, I know that that's a lot of what we will be using the statewide longitudinal data system for over time. And so a lot of that we don't have yet, but that's those are exactly the kind of things that we will be able to put a finer point on over time. You probably have more information about how many on the full day versus half day. That probably is data we could get now, right? Sorry, go ahead.
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, you stole my line. So, definitely some data that we can collaboratively look at and report back to the subcommittee.
And this subcommittee is working on getting the funding for that program and continuing the funding for it. We just talked about it yesterday, I think.
Senator,
I just want to say thank you for coming. And actually, it's interesting. I look up at the screen, and you got a lot of questions about us about why didn't you do this, why didn't you do that. And for the most part, as I look at those, we told you to do that. Every one of those programs was specifically sent to you from the legislature with specific requests to do this stuff. And so I appreciate coming back and letting us know what you found. And actually, I really appreciate the fact that it opened up questions about here about why didn't we do others? Because we should probably fund those other things if we think that we would like to have that information. Mm-hmm. So thank you very much. And these updates are really important for us to see that you are following through on the things we asked you to do. So thanks.
All right, with that, I'm going to close this meeting. And colleagues, we will be back here also in Hearing Room F on Thursday morning at 8:30. So we'll see you then.